before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them here.
Well, don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst.
And welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier, here on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, 91.9 FM, KDLL, Kenai Soul Dotna. I'm your host here, Bill Howell. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in. Well, we're a week late this month due to some technical difficulties from a power outage, but we are here, so let's get going with this month's beer news. Despite having been pulled together on very short notice following the demise of the Great Alaska Beer and Barley Wine Festival last November, the 2020 Alaska Craft Brew and Barley Wine Festival was a great success. Held at the Denaina Center in Anchorage on January 31st and February 1st, the festival featured 5,000 more square feet of floor space and many more food vendors. This year, 32 beers were entered in the winter seasonal competition. First place went to Firestone Walker's Parabola, second place to Resolution Brewing's Resolute, and third place to Fremont Brewing's Dark Star, with an honorable mention going to Maui Brewing's Night Diver. In the barley wine competition, there were 20 entries. The third place went to Anchorage Brewing's A Deal with the Devil. Second place went to Glacier Brewhouse's Big Woody, and the first place went to King Street Brewing's Seismic Barley Wine. This is the first time in recent memory that local breweries captured all three of the top awards for their barley wines. Planning is already underway for next year's festival, which should be even bigger and better. The sixth annual Frozen River Festival took place on Saturday, February 15th in Soldotna Creek Park. This year, the weather was fairly cooperative with temperatures in the upper teens and no snow or wind. Newcomer Cooper Landing Brewing Company won the People's Choice Award for the most popular brewery at the fest. We'll have interviews with them and some of the other participating breweries later in the show. Hoodoo Brewing Company in Fairbanks was the subject of a micro-documentary by WoodTeb. You can view the 5.5-minute film on YouTube. The Midnight Sun Brewing Company will be celebrating its 25th anniversary on May 5th of this year. One of its owners, Barb Miller, has made the following request. I'd like to capture stories / experiences from our fans or employees of How You Midnight Sun. Here are some ideas, but the writing is all up to you. How, when, where did you discover Midnight Sun? What do you love about Midnight Sun? What's your favorite Midnight Sun beer? How has Midnight Sun changed the trajectory of Alaska's beer craft scene? I'll collect your responses and hope to weave a cool and interesting article for posterity. Please email me at lafemmedebeer@gmail.com. Cheers and thanks. Anchorage Brewing Company has announced that this year's The Culmination Festival has been canceled. Here's what brewery owner Gabe Fletcher posted. We will be back July 24th, 2021. We will begin breaking ground on our new building / rooftop deck / orchard in May, so we felt like adding to the chaos might be too much. However, next year will be amazing with the new spaces. We will be able to take the festival to the next level and make it even more amazing. Thank you to everyone who has attended over the last years, and we are really looking forward to next year. Cheers, Gabe. Gabe Fletcher has also announced that Anchorage Brewing Company will be celebrating its 10-year anniversary on May 30th. So the Culmination Festival has been canceled, but maybe you can help us celebrate our 10-year anniversary instead. It's hard to believe it's been almost 10 years already. So much has happened in those years, so much to be thankful for. We have never actually celebrated a single anniversary, so we are going to make this one extra special. The White Buffalo is back. He is one of my favorite musicians. Jake and the boys are some of the best people out there. A few of my friends are making special 10th-year anniversary beers for us. We have Corey King from Side Project Brewing, Gene Broilette from Tired Hands Brewing, and Henry Nguyen from Monkish Brewing. Looking forward to seeing what they make for us. Familia will be serving up some amazing food for everyone as well. There are many more details to come and some surprises as well. Tickets will go on sale soon, so stay tuned. Senate Bill 52, the latest attempt to rewrite Alaska's alcohol laws, is back before the legislature. Sponsored by State Senator Peter Michicki, the bill has been 8 years in the making and has failed on several previous attempts, most recently in 2018. The most recent version contains a sort of grand compromise between bars and breweries. Under the proposed deal, the state will further restrict the number of brewery tap rooms. This is accomplished by requiring a brewery tap room to be licensed separately and changing the population limit required for the issuance of a brewery tap room license from 1 per 3,000 residents to 1 per 12,000 residents. In return, existing tap rooms will be allowed to stay open until 10 p.m., 2 hours later than currently permitted, and can host 4 music concerts per year, something currently banned. Breweries also will be permitted to host some public events like art shows and fundraisers. Dancing in tap rooms will no longer be banned, and other restrictions on entertainment will be relaxed. Without changes, the state on these topics would remain a mishmash of unclear language and wording overruled by the Alaska Supreme Court. The 1,200 barrel per year distribution limit on the brew pubs would also be lifted, allowing them to sell unlimited amounts to their distributors. Both the Brewers Guild of Alaska and the Alaska Cabaret Hotel, Restaurant, and Retailers Association, also known as CHAR, have agreed to the new language and appear to be ready to oppose any amendments that might threaten to derail the bill. Up next, we'll have interviews at the Frozen River Festival. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
How's it going, everybody? I'm Stefan Marty with Bleeding Heart Brewing Company.
And we're here at the Getting Ready for Frozen River Fest with Stefan and the rest of the brewers. So how's your new brewery construction coming?
You know, I would love to tell you that it's already done, we're ready to open, but just as with everything, it takes time. So we're in the middle of all the boring construction, putting up walls, pulling out concrete, that sort of thing. So yeah, none of the exciting stuff quite yet, but we'll be keeping everyone updated online. So follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, that sort of, you know, social media stuff.
So other than here, you guys got your beer on anywhere since your brewery shut down, you know, and you're kind of in the lull here?
Yeah, so to supplement our tap room sales, we've been distributing all over the state. We've got taps in Fairbanks, we've got taps all over Anchorage, Eagle River, Palmer, Wasilla. We're going to start working on getting some stuff down here, might do a tap takeover. And then we're also doing all the shows. We're doing obviously this one today. We'll be doing the Ferrandi Fest. So whenever anything pops up, we try to jump on it as quickly as possible.
Do you have a rough guesstimate yet when you're going to be open again at Alaska Picker?
We keep telling people summer of 2020. So stay tuned for an actual date.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, good luck, and thanks for coming to the fest. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Philip. I work over at Broken Tooth.
Thanks again for coming to our little beer fest here. So tell us what's up at Broken Tooth. What do you guys got coming down the line?
Well, today we're going to be doing our 2020 barley wine, our 2002 Darth Delirium, which is like a Belgian strong ale, dark, smoky. We also are doing, we're pairing up with Beach Tribe Soda Work Company in Anchorage. They do fresh juices and stuff like that. We're pairing with them, partnering with them on our beer Deckhand, where it's a ginger beer. It's so we backflush fresh pressed ginger into our beer, and it is delightful. I like to blend it with other things, but that's a whole nother thing. We're also pouring our Pribilof Pounder, which is a lager. We have our Area 52, which is just a nice session IPA, and the Rock Paper Citrus, which is a kind of like a brighter, citrusy pale.
You got any new releases coming up in the next few weeks that people should keep their eye out for?
We're just trying to get, I guess, the Darth Delirium back into the game for the winter season. I guess this is the one I guess people should look out for.
Yeah, everybody loves that one, so great. Well, hey, Philip, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, guys.
Hi there, I'm Jack Wade from Bear Paw River Brewing Company in Wasilla, Alaska.
Wade boys.
One of the Wade brothers, three of four, and we're down here trying to have a good time and pour some beers. We've got, we brought four beers. We bought a 2017 Russian Imperial Stout, barrel aged. We brought an amber, a nice sessionable 5.3% out amber. We brought our Frontiersman IPA, and what else did we bring? And then we brought a hazy IPA.
Great. Well, let's talk about some of the stuff you guys are working on up in Wasilla. How's the new location coming? Is everything still on track?
Yep, everything is still on track. We're looking at a early summer start on the project and then hopefully opening this time next year, Christmas to February next year.
Okay, so winter of next year.
Winter of next year. Everything is on track, though. We're near complete with the design, and so
pizza too, right?
That's right. We're going to do pizza and beer. Emphasis on just a few options, 5 to 7 menu items, 5 to 7 different pizzas with a salad, and then of course the many beers that we're going to have on draft. So,
and you guys have something coming the 22nd for the it's a release for two beers.
We've got stuff going on all the time, you know. Yeah, we've got several one-off releases planned through the winter and into the new season. We've got a Bock, I believe, coming out. We've got a bunch of stuff. So,
well, good. Well, hey, thanks for coming to the fest and appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
All right, cheers. Thanks.
Kenai River Brewing Company at the Frozen River Fest. So, looks like another great year, huh, Doug?
Yeah, perfect weather, conditions are awesome, breweries are setting up, we're almost ready to roll.
Getting there. What's coming up in the next month or so with Kenai River?
So at the festival, we're actually going to release a couple things that we haven't done. We have a new lager, it's a Helles, which is my favorite lager that's made, so we're going to sneak peek that. And then we'll have it at the brewery for just a little bit, and then you won't see it again until closer to the summer. So, yeah, we have that kind of poking its head out. But, yeah, as far as other things, we have a new seltzer. Everybody's crazy about the Kenai Claw, right, Bill?
It's a sign of the end of civilization, if you ask me. But what do I know?
Yeah, it's fun. It's different. It'll be cool.
Maybe and you should put some glitter in it.
Well, I do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, edible glitter. Yes. Yeah. So, besides that, we've got brewers. Our brewers are actively creating new things, and we're going to be canning new things this year. And yeah, we have a lot of neat things on the horizon.
Well, great. Well, we'll look forward to having them. Maybe one day they'll even be a mild ale.
I keep hearing that every now and then. Yes, a little whisper.
Alrighty, well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, Doug. Appreciate it.
Yep.
And we're here with Devin from 49th State. So, hey, Devin, welcome back.
Thanks.
Always welcome back here at Soldata. How's things going at 49th State?
All right, so a lot of changes going on with 49th. Our production facility down at the old Schlumberger Oil Field Services next to the railroad tracks in Anchorage is functioning, and they're brewing beer down there, getting everything dialed in. 30 barrel, 4-vessel brew house. Our largest fermenter is 120 barrels. We'll be dialing in all our numbers down there and then brewing all of our core beers for all two locations, Healy and the pub in downtown Anchorage. And I will be running the pub and doing all the experimental fun stuff.
Excellent, excellent. Is the one at the production brewery, it's going to have a tap room eventually, right?
It eventually will have a tap room. They're more focused on getting the brewing done before to move forward with that. But yes, eventually in a beer garden, a bunch of fun stuff happening down there.
Cool, cool. So got any new releases coming out in the next 2 or 3 or 4 weeks?
Yeah, so we released a first brew of the Urban Wilderness, which was brewed by Dennis Urban back in the day at Sleeping Lady and won a silver medal both in World Beer Cup and GABF. Kind of digging that out of the archives. We had Denny come in and help us brew the first batch, just to help us dial in the grain bill and the flavors. And then we rebrewed it just the other day with the actual English Whitbread yeast that he used and won those awards with. So that's coming out.
Memory serves, that was like the first canned beer in Alaska, or one of the very first.
Yep, they did. They manually filled and seamed it. There was even a manual seamer. It wasn't even mechanical. But yeah, it was really nice to have Denny there. But she actually, he lives down here on the peninsula. So we may see him roaming around. But it was really, really a pleasure to brew that beer with him that day.
So what else you got coming out?
We got a oatmeal coffee, somewhat imperial stout. Oatmeal stouts really aren't in the imperial range, but we went ahead and made it that way. And it was blended with about 2.5 gallons of cold brew concentrate from Black Cup Coffee. Pretty proud to be partnering with them. We went and had a cupping and tasted about 15 different varieties of beans and blindly tasted them and picked out the one we thought would go best in this coffee. And it's really delicious. And I'm going to be pouring a keg of it here today.
Excellent. Look forward to having it. Anything else exciting or new?
Summer's coming up, and I'll be working like a dog. I know that'll be happening pretty soon.
Well, that's the good problem to have, right? Yeah. Hey, thanks, Devin. Appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
My name's Tony. I'm one of the brewers at King Street Brewing.
So first off, congratulations on the gold from the Alaska Craft Brew and Barley Wine Festival. I don't remember the new name.
Yep.
So congratulations. Are you pouring that here today?
We are not. We brought some other beers today.
All right. So besides basking in the glow of your wonderful victory, what's King Street going to be doing in the next month, 6 weeks?
Well, we're about to release our Imperial beers in a new style. We've been doing 25-ounce bottles. We now have 16-ounce cans. So that's probably our newest change. Other than that, we're just getting ready for summer. We're going to start ramping up.
Are you going to be selling them individual cans, 4-packs? What's the plan?
They'll be 4-packs, just like the IPAs, with the full pop-off lid as well.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Any big plans, anything besides the cans, anything new you're working on?
You know, nothing to my knowledge. We could be adding production space, but not in the next couple months, a little bit further out than that.
Well, hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
No problem. Thank you.
My name's Sean Jackson. I'm the head brewer for Midnight Sun Brewing Company.
So what is Midnight Sun going to be releasing in the next month or two?
Next month or two, well, the big one is May is going to be our 25th anniversary. So we did a Belgian quad that's been aging in cognac barrels for the past year and a half, 2 years. So that's going to be our big release coming up in May. Up and before then, we have a hazy IPA coming out. We're doing a kettle soured Brett beer, primary fermented with Brettanomyces. That's really the next two we have coming out right now.
The anniversary beer is going to be in cans like the last couple?
The anniversary will be in 12-ounce bottles. Yep. And we're doing a fancy label, a new label for it, all sorts. It's gonna be a good thing. It'll also be bottle conditioned as well. So we're pulling out of barrels actually next month, and then it'll be naturally carbonated in the bottles until it's released in May 6th.
Cool. So what are you pouring today?
Today we have a new release, Snowfall Saison. It's brewed with pink peppercorns. We have our Belgian Trappel Panty Peeler, Sockeye Red IPA, our staple IPA, and a new release as well. We have Sun Thief Porter. That's also available in 6 and 12-ounce cans.
Well, hey, great. Thanks for coming down to the fest. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Calling all KDLL listeners. Would you like to have a direct voice into what you hear on the air? KDLL is seeking members for its Community Advisory Board. The CAB meets quarterly to gather public input and evaluate how well KDLL programming meets the needs of the community. If this gets your ring of approval, contact Jenny at KDLL at info@kdll.org or 283-8433.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. In this month's feature, I'd like to talk about the Drunken Monkey Hypothesis. In past shows, I've talked about the strong archaeological evidence that suggests that the desire to ferment grain into alcoholic beverages, as opposed to baking them into bread, was the driving force behind mankind's move from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle into settled agriculture. However, there are other scientists who suspect that mankind's love affair with alcohol goes much further back than just 10 or 15,000 years. Indeed, they believe that consuming alcohol might just have been one of the key factors that made us humans in the first place. This is the drunken monkey hypothesis. The drunken monkey hypothesis proposes that alcohol, and primarily the ethanol molecule, is routinely consumed by all animals that eat fruits and nectar. As first worked out by Louis Pasteur in the 19th century, fermentation is a natural process deriving from the metabolic action of yeast on sugar molecules. The yeasts produce alcohol to kill off their bacterial competitors, and the booze accumulates at low concentrations within fruits and nectar. It also wafts into the environment, producing a downwind vapor trail that reliably indicates the presence of fruits and sugars. Any animal that can sense and follow this odor upwind will come to the source of ethanol and, of course, the sugars within the fruit. In tropical forests, ripe fruit occurs patchily, so any ability to find it over long distances is beneficial. Not only does alcohol provide a useful long-distance sensory cue, it can also act as a feeding stimulant via the well-studied aperitif effect. Today, we often drink when eating, and overall food intake tends to go up as a consequence. The psychoactive and pleasurable features of alcohol certainly make us feel happier, particularly in social contexts, but they also act to increase overall energy gain. For animals searching in a rainforest for scarce nutritional resources, it's similarly a good idea to consume ripe fruits as quickly as possible before the competition arrives. But do they ever actually get drunk? There are lots of funny anecdotes about apparently drunken animals in nature, including moose feeding on fermented apples in Sweden and cedar wax wings in the American Midwest that are too buzzed to fly. Only rarely, however, have these animal drinkers ever been scientifically studied, and direct proof of inebriation is even more rare. Instead, the guts of fruit eaters typically fill to satiation well before incapacitating blood alcohol levels can be attained. Even though some animals can eat up to 10% of their body weight a day in ripe fruit, the typical concentrations of alcohol in fruit pulp are only about 0.5 to 3%, which means they never get drunk. And this is a good thing, too, especially for flying fruit eaters such as toucans and fruit bats, given that predators are always on the lookout for the weak and the vulnerable. And most species in the wild, including fruit flies, have really good enzymes to degrade any ingested alcohol. But we're different. Around 10 million years ago, as our ape ancestors progressively became more upright and began to walk about bipedally, an interesting change occurred in their physiological ability to process alcohol. In a 2015 Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences paper, scientists focused on ADH4 genes, which code for the first enzyme to encounter and metabolize alcohol during digestion. The particular genetic code for this protein differs across species. Comparing sequences from 18 primates, the scientists discovered a single-letter DNA change in this enzyme that increases ethanol metabolism 40-fold. This mutation was found in chimpanzees, gorillas, and humans, suggesting it was also probably present in the last common ancestor of all three species. These animals were walking about the forest floor and within savannas and might have simply been obtaining greater access to fallen fruits that had been fermenting longer and thus contained more alcohol. Whatever the initial advantages might have been for this particular mutation, we have retained it into modern times. What once helped to find food more efficiently in the wild has become a major part of human culture, with alcohol both loved and abused worldwide. The drunken monkey hypothesis was originally put forth by Robert Dudley, a professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley, in a 2000 article. In it, he proposed that apes and early humans evolved to seek out ethyl alcohol because it led them to food. These early primates preferred fruit over any other food. But in order to locate that desirable fruit and those crucial calories, these primates couldn't just hit the local Fred Meyer. They had to rely on their sense of smell. And one thing that routinely led them to fruit was the smell of alcohol. Ergo, we developed a taste for alcohol because its smell kept us alive. As Dudley concludes in his article, Although diverse factors contribute to the expression of alcoholism as a clinical syndrome, historical selection for the consumption of ethanol can be viewed as a subtle yet pervasive evolutionary influence on modern humans. His theory casts an attraction to alcohol as an adaptation to the natural world. However, in modern times, where booze is plentiful, this adaptation produces a major public health problem for some people, according to his hypothesis. His ideas echo the thrifty gene hypothesis, which proposes that millennia of natural selection for an efficient metabolism led to the prevalence of diabetes and obesity amid today's ready availability of fat and sugar in our diets. If this hypothesis is correct, developing a taste for alcohol, that is, the low levels of alcohol found in nature, could have given our ancestors an advantage. In a forest full of animals competing for energy-rich food, drunken monkeys would have access to an untapped resource. It wasn't until millions of years later, after Homo sapiens created beverages with unnaturally high ethanol concentrations, i.e., beer, wine, spirits, that alcohol consumption became a social and public health issue. According to Dudley, alcohol abuse and addiction are an evolutionary hangover of a deep-rooted taste for fermented sugars, beneficial and adaptive long ago, but potentially at least unhealthy and destructive today. Up next, we'll have an interview with the people behind the Cooper Landing Brewing Company here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM. Today, for our interview, we're really lucky to have Nels Barnett of Cooper Landing Brewing and his head brewer, Ruth Nelson. So, hey, welcome to you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Appreciate you guys being here. First up, how's things going with the new construction? We've been watching it on Facebook. Looks like you guys are about ready for some stainless steel to show up, right?
Yeah, we finished the brewery floor last week, and the walls and everything, and lights are up. Most of the building's painted. Yeah, we're pretty far into finishes now, so tanks are... We're supposed to show up yesterday, but with the avalanche mitigation, I guess the train's been delayed, so we're going to have to wait a couple extra days, but we should have them inside next week.
Great. And refresh my memory, if I remember, you guys were going with a 5-barrel system?
It's a 10-barrel.
10-barrel. Okay, yeah. Good. The bigger, the better.
Yeah.
And I think when we interviewed you last, you were planning to do an all-electric system. Is that still where you're at?
That changed, actually. We couldn't get enough power to the site to do that. So it's going to be a propane indirect fire brew house.
Cool. And you got how much tankage coming in?
We got 80 barrels worth of fermenter space and actually 40 barrels worth of bright tank space.
Great.
So, yeah, and some serving tanks for the tap room as well.
Excellent. I think I heard somewhere that your new brewery actually is going to have a couple of apartments in it that you'll be able to rent out during the summer and stuff like that. Is that correct?
Well, it's been talked about. it does have two apartments upstairs, but no one can really agree on what we should do with them. I'm in the camp, let's rent them out and make some money, but you know, it's a family thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, sounds like somebody who's got their money sunk in the project. Let's get some of that back. So
just a few bucks.
So the $64,000 question, when are you guys planning, you think, to have your soft opening?
Sometime in May.
Okay.
Yeah.
And official grand opening in June?
Yeah, that date's actually been set for June 13th, which is the Saturday after the river opens for fishing.
All right. Well, yeah. Everybody out there, mark your calendars for June 13th and Cooper Landing.
Yeah, it'll be a fun day.
So, hey, sure. Ruth, this is the first time we've had a chance to talk to you. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your background, how you got into brewing, how you ended up as a, you know, head brewer there in Cooper Landing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually born and raised Cooper Landing, and then I went to college at Oregon State and kind of fell into the fermentation program there. Graduated from there, I briefly worked at Crux Fermentation Project in Bend and then Deschutes Brewery in Bend. And when I saw that Nels was opening the brewery, I kind of emailed him and was like, hey, hi, I exist. I'd like to come back to Cooper Landing. and he's been super awesome and came back home.
So my understanding is you've been doing most of the brewing here recently, right? In the old brewery?
Yeah, since about October.
Okay, great. Yeah,
let's be honest, she's been doing all the
Well, how about, I've kind of talked to Nels about this in the past, and I'll ask you, what's your brewing, for want of a better word, your brewing philosophy? Do you have a kind of a style of beer styles of beer that you really favor? When you go in to create a recipe or whatever, what are you trying to do with brewing?
Oh, man, that's a loaded question.
I know, that's why I asked
it. If it was my option, I'd make pilsners all day long. They're my favorite. Super easy to drink, and they're fun to make, but IPAs are what sell. So doing a lot of IPAs and the hazy IPA train right now.
Well, I had some of your pilsner at the Frozen River Fest, and I thought it was really good. And apparently a lot of other people liked your stuff since you guys won the People's Choice Award. So definitely congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I hope you had a good time at the festival.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, you won't find Deschutes doing a festival in February and 10 degrees above whatever the temperature was that day.
No, not at all.
So what else you guys got planned? I know, obviously, you're working to get the brewery open. And then what? Bottling? Canning? You got any follow-on plans?
Well, there is a canner planned for. We haven't purchased anything yet. Ruth and I and one other person, we're going to go down to the Brewers Conference in San Antonio in April, and that's kind of, we're hoping we can, you know, see what there is to see and decide on something. But of course, you know, it's one of the last things to get bought, so the money's kind of dwindling a little bit, but it definitely is in the cards. It's part of our business plan for sure, so definitely be picking one up.
That's good. I think everywhere you look, that seems to be the direction everybody is heading in, both up here and down in the lower 48, that we're going to cans. And in fact, I read an article not too long ago where they basically wrote off the 22-ounce bottle. That's people are going to stop using those pretty shortly.
Been a long time since I bought a bomber. To be honest with you.
So anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners that's coming up, or anywhere you guys are going to be, any new releases that you've got planned between the next couple of months?
Well, as far as festivals go, we'll be at Rondi, and we'll be at Palmer Ale House in April sometime. They do their tap takeover for a week. I'm not sure the dates. And then we'll be going to Haynes in May, and that's pretty much going to round up the festivals for us until fall.
Is this your first time at Haynes?
No, we actually went 2 years ago. We didn't make it last year, but we went, and I guess that'd have been 2018, and it was one of the best times I've ever had. It's just a great experience.
Yeah, Haynes, that's a wonderful festival.
It's great. Ruth hasn't been, so.
Oh, you're gonna enjoy the heck out of it, Ruth. Tell you.
Yeah, first time.
Particularly the Brewers dinner beforehand.
We're going to be having a beer there for that.
Yeah, that's as much fun as the festival itself, I think.
Yeah, Ruth signed us up for a beer tasting, so she has to give a speech.
There you go. All right, well, hey, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Really appreciate it. And, you know, good luck with everything. We'll keep watching it on the line, keeping an eye out for the soft opening. As soon as you know a date, shoot it to me, and I'll make sure I get it out on the air here for everybody. And we'll definitely see you on the 13th of June.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much.
This is Bill Howell, Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.net. We'll be right back with our next segment. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.net. Let's talk about beer and fine dining. We've all got our pet peeves, the little things that really drive us up the wall. One of mine is sitting down in a nice restaurant and asking to see their beer list, only to be told, "Oh, we have everything." Really? There are over 5,000 breweries in the U.S. alone, so a conservative estimate will be that there are at least 20,000 plus beers brewed in the U.S., not to mention all the cool imports out there. And you've got everything. That's impressive. Okay, I'll have a 1998 Thomas Hardy's Ale. At this point, the poor server usually realizes that they are dealing with a beer geek, and my wife sighs as she is again reminded that she was foolish enough to marry one. The server then admits that by everything, he or she really means Bud, Bud Light, Miller, Miller Light, Coors, Coors Light, etc., i.e. the same run-of-the-mill macro brews that everyone else has. If I'm really lucky, they might have one local brew of some sort on tap or in a bottle. It will probably be served way too cold and may be so old that it does not taste anything like it should, but that's the way it goes, right? Can't expect to get what you're paying good money for, i.e. a quality craft beer. What bothers me most about this is that no self-respecting restaurant would ever respond to a request to see its wine list by saying, "We have everything." Nor would they think serving just a run-of-the-mill house white sufficient to satisfy the tastes of all their customers and pair with all their dishes. But they think nothing of treating beer in such a cavalier fashion. This is especially galling, as beer makes a much superior pairing with most foods as compared to wine. Since beer is carbonated, the effervescence of the bubbles actually allows it to disperse more aromas. Given its myriad of styles, beer is far more versatile at mealtime than wine could ever hope to be. Are you having fajitas? The bracing hoppiness of an English pale ale will cut right through the dish's spiciness. Are you having spinach salad? A nice tangy wheat beer will counterbalance the acidity of the dressing. If you're having chocolate cake, then a bold, roasty imperial stout will balance the richness of your dessert. Beer works across all these categories, which is not the case with wine. However, to quote the great Bob Dylan, "The times they are a-changin'." More and more chefs are discovering the utility of versatility of beer, both as an ingredient in and as an accompaniment to fine dining. True beer lists are becoming more and more common in fine dining establishments, taking their rightful place alongside the wine list. Coming from the other direction, more and more breweries and brew pubs are serving food, and that food is becoming increasingly sophisticated. A couple of decades ago, a brew pub could get away with serving the standard sort of deep-fried pub food, but today's patrons are increasingly looking for something better. If they're going to go to the trouble to seek out quality handcrafted beers, they expect to be served quality handcrafted food as well. We can see the intersection of these trends in the growing popularity of what are loosely called beer dinners, in which each course is accompanied by one or two beers specially selected to go with that course. Under that general umbrella, there are many different subcategories of beer dinner. Some showcase beers from a single brewery, while others might focus on beers from a specific region of the country or even imports from another country, such as Britain or Belgium. I've attended dinners which were billed as a duel between two breweries, in which each course was accompanied by two beers, one from each brewery, and the patrons voted on whose beer paired best with each course. Some dinners focus on aged beers. The famous Humphrey's Beer Dinner, held in Anchorage each year during Alaska Beer Week, showcases hard-to-find brews plucked from the extensive personal cellar of Humphrey's owner Billy Opinski. Whatever the chosen theme for any particular dinner, they all share one thing in common. They are a celebration of the excellence of finely crafted beer and its amazing ability to accompany and enhance delicious food. Here on the peninsula, restaurants are beginning to dip their toes into the beer dinner waters. The Flats Bistro in Kenai recently held its third beer dinner and is planning a fourth for sometime in March. Kenai River Brewing Company has held two such dinners since opening its new tasting room and is planning another for Valentine's Day. Seward Brewing Company also hosted such a dinner last summer. Given the success of these pioneering efforts, it's logical to assume that the opportunities to enjoy beer dinners here on the peninsula will continue to increase. If you're a beer lover like me, you should want to see this trend continue. The way to make that happen is to give feedback. If you love beer and don't wish to see it mistreated, speak up. Let the server and/or the manager know if you're not happy with the beer choices at the establishment or how their beers are served. If your complaints are ignored, go spend your money someplace else. Conversely, if you find good beer properly served, let the folks doing so know how much you appreciate it. Go to beer dinners and let the staff and owners know just how happy you are to do so. Positive feedback is just as important as negative feedback. Let's put our money where our mouths are and teach people out there to respect beer. This is Bill Howell, drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's Brewing Science segment, we're going to talk about adjuncts. In the world of brewing, the term adjunct refers to any ingredient other than malted wheat or barley that is added to a beer to supply fermentable sugars. Examples of typical adjuncts include oats, rye, corn, rice, honey, and various sugars. A brewer might use adjuncts for any number of reasons, ranging from saving money by employing a cheaper source of fermentable sugar to trying to favorably impact some element of the finished product's quality, such as color, flavor, or head retention. Adjuncts have been derided by craft beer lovers because of their wide use in many major American beer brands to lighten the color and the flavor of the beer produced. It would be impossible to brew a beer as light in body as Budweiser using 100% barley malt, as barley contains too many unfermentable sugars, which would remain and contribute to the beer's body. Only by using highly fermentable adjuncts such as corn can such a beer be produced. All the major American lager brands use some combination of corn and/or rice to achieve their current low state of malt flavor. However, many uses of adjuncts are quite traditional. American colonists often supplemented their mash with whatever starch was at hand, with pumpkins being a particularly popular adjunct. In the mid-19th century, German lager brewers who established themselves in the American Midwest found the six-row barley grown there to be much heavier and harsher tasting than the two-row European variety which they had been accustomed to use. In order to produce their beloved lager beers using six-row barley, these brewers hit upon adding corn to the mash bill to produce quality lagers using inferior barley. Though initially done to compensate for not having access to European barley, this practice of using adjuncts was gradually taken to extreme, eventually producing the insipid American lagers of today. Many Belgian and Belgian-style beers also use sugar as an adjunct, adding candy sugar, which is often caramelized to add color and flavor to the beer. In particular, dark candy sugar, usually in the form of a heavy syrup, gives many dark Belgian beers distinctive raisin-like caramel flavors. These sugars, frequently used as up to 20% of the mash bill, are highly fermentable and can help beers obtain a very low residual sugar profile, meaning the beers can have higher alcohol content without having heavy mouthfeel. Kenai River Brewing in Soldotna is famous for its Gummy Bear Triple, a Belgian-style beer in which the adjunct sugar comes from the addition of several pounds of the aforementioned candies to the boil. American craft brewers use various sugars to attain high specific gravities in other beer styles such as barley wines, double IPAs, and other strong ales. Honey is another popular adjunct, which can be added to the brew kettle to increase specific gravity or even post-fermentation, where it adds sweetness and honey aromatics. While today's adjuncts have a bad reputation amongst beer lovers, given their role in producing beers such as Budweiser or Coors, there is in fact a long tradition behind their use in brewing. Used properly and for the right reasons, they are an essential tool in the home or craft brewer's toolkit. We'll be right back here on Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's beer style segment, I'd like to shift gears a bit and talk about something a little different than a specific beer style. Given that it's February, I want to talk a bit about a movement out in the craft beer world, which you may or may not have heard of. It's called Flagship February. The concept behind Flagship February is simple. There are, by some estimates, in excess of 22,000 operating breweries in the world today. At a very conservative count of only a dozen brands per brewery, that makes in excess of 250,000 different beers being sold around the globe. Plus, of course, the multitude of special releases that for some breweries number in the hundreds per year. That's a lot of beer. Increasingly, it seems that what leads people to drink a beer is less whether or not it's good than it is whether it's new or, better still, rare. While this is not necessarily a bad thing, new brands and styles keep things exciting after all, what sometimes gets lost in the special release noise this produces are the beers that pave the way for the remarkable global beer market we presently have at our disposal, or in other words, the flagship beers that got us here. The idea of Flagship February is not to try to shore up sales of the flagship beers of various breweries. That's the job of the marketing and sales divisions of those breweries. The thinking is that flagship beers have much to teach new drinkers and remind older drinkers, and if they fall off the radar so far that they disappear completely, we will all be that much poorer for it. So what makes something a flagship beer? The origins of the term flagship are appropriately nautical, befitting a beverage that's about 95% water. According to Merriam-Webster, its first definition comes from the Navy, with the flagship being a vessel used by the commanding officer or a group of naval ships, characteristically a flag officer entitled by custom to fly a distinguishing flag. Used more loosely, it's the lead ship in a fleet of vessels, typically the first, largest, fastest, most heavily armed, or best known. Over time, the definition has moved on to land and is now more commonly used to designate the finest, largest, or most important one of a group of things. So, for example, if you have a chain of stores, the location that is your best or biggest is your flagship store. With beer, a flagship is the beer that defines a brewery. It's the one that you immediately think of when you hear the brewery's name, the one that most people associate with that brand. In most cases, it's their best-selling beer and often the one that outsells all other offerings by a wide margin. A good flagship also allows a brewery to be able to afford the seasonals, specialty beers, and the other less profitable beers in their lineup. One might think that the brewery decides which beer is their flagship, but that's not always the case. Often, they may expect that a certain beer will be the one that sells the best, but consumers have a different idea. There are numerous examples of this. Deschutes Brewing in Bend, Oregon, did not believe their Black Butte Porter would be their best-selling beer, but consumers really took to it, and the rest is history. For many people, especially people above a certain age, a brewery's flagship beer is probably the first non-mainstream beer they drank, with countless stories of the first beer someone enjoyed that made them love good beer. In my case, that beer was Anchor Brewing's Anchor Steam. For other folks around my age, it might be Sierra Nevada's Pale Ale, Sam Adams' Boston Lager, or even the long-defunct Pete's Wicked Ale. For each of us, these beers are our cultural signposts in the recent evolution of the global beer market. But flagship beers are also so much more. Although their sales have in recent years been declining, often because people are starting to consider them boring as they chase after the next big thing, a good flagship is the beer that still tastes good as you remember it, whenever you go back to it. It's a brewery's flagship precisely because it tastes exactly the same from bottle to bottle, can to can, and draught to draught, with a consistency that will always be the hallmark of quality brewing. So this February, I'd encourage you to pay a return visit to an old friend. Seek out that beer you have fond memories of but haven't tasted recently. Does it taste the same as you remember, or has your palate changed? In a beer world that's awash in new releases and faddish beer styles, it's often refreshing and enlightening to take a step back and revisit the classics. After all, they became classics for a reason. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go out and pick up a six-pack of Anchor Steam. We'll be right back with our next segment here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. For our last segment this month, it's time for Beer Gear. In this month's Beer Gear, I'll be reviewing a new online course called The Everyday Guide to Beer. This is a new offering from The Great Courses. If you've never heard of it, The Great Courses offer a series of college-level audio and video courses produced and distributed by The Teaching Company, an American company based in Chantilly, Virginia. As of 2015, it had created over 700 courses and sold over 14 million copies. I've taken courses from them in the past, covering subjects of interest to me, and I've often wondered if they'd ever get around to offering one on craft beer. Well, now they have. The beer course is taught by Charles W. Bamforth, a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. He received his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Hull. He's also a senior quality advisor to Sierra Nevada Brewing Company and an honorary professor in the School of Biosciences at the University of Nottingham. He's been part of the brewing industry since 1978, holding such positions as Deputy Director General of Brewing Research International, as well as Quality Assurance Manager and Research Manager at Bass Brewers. I've read several of his books on beer and had the great good fortune of meeting him in person a decade ago. He's an outstanding choice to lecture on the subject of beer. The course itself consists of 12 lectures, each typically about 30 minutes in length. Topics include the history of beer, how beer is made, various beer styles, how to enjoy beer, pairing beer with food, and beer and human health. Overall, it's a very comprehensive overview. Nominally, the cost of the course is $170, but The Great Courses runs very frequent sales. For example, in a sale that just ended on February 27th, you could have purchased the course for only $24.95. So my advice is to watch the website if you're interested. As someone who has created and taught his own college-level beer class, I was very impressed with the quality of the instruction provided. The only flaw in learning about beer online is the fact that you can't taste the beers being discussed. With that caveat, I strongly recommend The Everyday Guide to Beer. If you're interested, check it out at www.thegreatcourses.com. This month's closing beer quote is from Roger Green Ingersoll. What light is to the eyes, what air is to the lungs, what love is to the heart, beer is to the soul of man. And on that happy thought, until next time, cheers.